You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Holy Crowley Hour. Good evening, and welcome to the special Christmas Eve edition of the Holy Crowley Hour, which is only the second radio show in American history to be impeached by Congress. And the vote wasn't even close. Of course, the first show to be impeached was This American Life. For regular listeners of the Holy Crowley Hour, apparently the Metamucil is working. Regular listeners might also know that we usually begin the show with our origin story, how the Holy Crowley Hour came to be under the auspices of Carl Crowley, Aleister Crowley's little-known brother. But since this is the eve of Christmas Eve, Carl himself, in the spirit of the holiday, has given us permission to dispense with all that and get right to the show. And what a show we have for you on this special night, the second night of Hanukkah. Our guest is actor and storyteller David Loftus, and David, also in the spirit of the holiday, will be reading two Christmas stories for us. First up, we'll hear the Sherlock Holmes holiday classic, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle by Arthur Conan Doyle. Then we'll close the show out with perhaps the greatest Christmas short story of all time. And no, that's not the Paul Lynde special, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which aired only once on ABC on December 7th, 1977, a day that will live in infamy. So while we wait for David to come down the KBOO chimney, we'd like you at home to get comfortable. Put on your jammies and slippers, grab a hot toddy, and sit back and relax. One thing we can guarantee, if there's a hot toddy joke to be made, Paul Lynde already used it in his Christmas special. You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation. We're very happy to welcome live in the studio with us tonight, David Loftus. David is a true Renaissance man. He's a stage and film actor, a voice actor and author, a musician, singer, dancer, journalist, editor, tour guide, a model for both video and print, and as you'll find out, an amazing reader. In fact, David has a long-running series, Storytime for Grown-Ups, in which he does live readings for grown-ups and, of course, minors who manage to slip past the bouncers. David, thanks so much for joining us on this Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it's delightful to be here, Ken.
Now, before we get to the Christmas stories, let's first talk a little bit about your Storytime for Grown-Ups. You've said that you started reading aloud when your grandmother broke her hip. And she was laid up for months. She was convalescent. She had a new hip joint. That must have sparked something in you to keep it going for a wider audience.
Well, she was a heavy reader and of books and things, and I was a heavy reader too. And when she was laid up for months with a new steel ball and socket joint, and couldn't get around for quite a while, I was about 13 or 14, I guess, and I started reading her news stories in the newspaper and articles from magazines. And we just gradually moved on to short stories and even whole books. And once she was up and around, I'd go over and visit her. And I read her David Niven's autobiography, The Moon's a Balloon, and Ray Bradbury's wonderful magical novel, Something Wicked This Way Comes, because I was all excited about it. I just read it. And it went from there.
And she's up and walking around now, or
no, she's long past.
But... oh, well, it's a good way to start. Now, how and when did you go from that to Storytime for Grown-Ups, the series of live readings?
Well, again, there were a couple of other steps. I read aloud to my girlfriends when I was in my teens and 20s. I read stories to classmates in college, and then. During and after college, I was in Massachusetts then, I started volunteering reading books for the blind. So I read a half dozen or more books over several years as a volunteer for the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. And then I came back home to Oregon after my what I call my 10-year layover in Boston. And, you know, for a while I was working as a newspaper reporter. And again, you know, I would read aloud sometimes to girlfriends. That was a fun thing to do. Most of them tolerated it.
Were there any particular favorites?
Favorite stories?
Yeah, that you read.
The Offshore Pirate is a wonderful romantic fantasy by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
I don't know that
one. I've read many times. There are several favorite Sherlock Holmes stories that I read. I've read often. Lots of Ray Bradbury stories. He's delightful. His language rolls off the tongue. It's very poetic prose. And my gosh, once I got, and then Joanna Rose, who was working at Powell's in the late 90s, started organizing some of her actor reader friends to do literature and performance, which is what she called it. And I did an evening of Lewis Carroll. I did an evening of John Donne. And
wow, was that at Powell's or at another
Powell's
venue?
Books. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was at Powell's Books. And then Powell's kind of let that slide off because they had so many author events they were hosting. So
there's like two or three every night now. Yeah.
So then we did it for a while at the Downtown Borders Books. And I also did the Borders down near the shopping center south of the city.
Bridgeport Village?
Yeah,
that one?
Bridgeport Village. I'd read at Borders a few times there. And then occasionally we do them at libraries. At various times I've read stuff at Multnomah County Library, Hillsborough, Tigard. And then I got the idea, I think it was about 2003 or 4, to just do it myself.
Was it called Storytime for Grownups at
that point?
That's
when it became Storytime for Grownups. That's my name.
And you mentioned reading at Grendel's for many years.
And that's where I did it, yes.
That's just a block
just
away from us here at Cable.
Just a half block north of Cable. Almost every month. There were some times when I was so busy I couldn't get to it. But over the course of about 8 years, I did a lot of different readings at Grendel's and developed quite a file of material.
Now, audiobooks might be changing things, but generally, adults, grown-ups, are not used to being read to. It's mostly kids who get bedtime stories from their parents.
If they do, even more.
Now, what are some of the typical reactions at your readings from people who might not have been read to since they were little, if at all?
People love it. I have half a dozen to a dozen regular folks who have been coming to my readings for years on end. But if I can get an announcement out on the web or sometimes even in the Mercury or Willamette Week, I will get strangers who particularly love that particular author I'm reading.
And you're at the Rose City Book Pub now. In fact, they opened, I think, last November, and you've been there almost as long?
They opened in October of 2018.
Oh, that's what I meant a year ago in November, yeah.
2018. Uh-huh. And I started with them last January 2019, so I read,
most of the time they've been open.
Yeah.
And what's the crowds like there? Well, one of the cool things there, Elise Schumach runs the place.
Yeah.
And they combine a bookstore and a bar. So you can order a drink or a coffee if you want.
Yeah.
Read a book or listen to Story Time for Grownups.
Yeah. And as I said, I get regulars who turn out. And then sometimes the particular author or the theme I'm doing attracts strangers who are, you know, really thrilled. The night I did Shirley Jackson, a couple of women were there, and I chatted with them during the break at the bar, and one of them said, my partner brought me here. She didn't tell me what it was going to be. She's my favorite author, and I'm just so excited.
Was it The Lottery that you read? The Shirley Jackson piece?
I don't think I read that. I'm not exactly sure which things I did that particular night. I've certainly done the lottery.
That's the one I know.
Yeah, I've certainly done the lottery. She has written a number of really delightful, lovely stories, too. There are plenty of other creepy ones. But
now, you'd not be reading creepy ones tonight. These are Christmas stories. No. And the first one you picked is Arthur Conan Doyle's The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle. It was first published in 1892. It features Sherlock Holmes, and that's not someone we usually associate with the Christmas holiday.
No.
David, can you tell us a little bit about the story and why you picked it for us tonight for our Christmas Eve special?
Well, this is one of the ones I've read more often than the other because I personally love it. Leslie Klinger, the guy who edited the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, the three-volume box set that came out 10, 12 years ago, when he came to do an appearance at the Multnomah County Library, I went and got my copies autographed. And I remember somebody in the audience asked him, do you have a favorite Holmes story? And he said, this one, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, because it's a Christmas story. It has a sort of theme of forgiveness. It's not too dark. And, you know, he said it was one of his favorites, and it's perfectly understandable why. It's got lots of interesting, colorful characters and voices. It's a fun story to read.
Well, let's listen. And this is a treat for me being here in the studio with you, and I hope it's a treat for people listening at home. Here's David with Arthur Conan Doyle's The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle with the great detective Sherlock Holmes.
One other note before I start, Ken. I did have to cut this for length so it could fit it. We could fit it into the evening.
Oh, you wanted to mention that. You know, yeah. About three pages that show his detective expertise in there.
The Holmes fans out there who are familiar with the story are immediately going to notice that a set piece is missing. There's a good three pages early in the story that Holmes spends spinning out these incredible deductions about the owner of a hat. All he's got to look at is this hat that has been retrieved, and then he proceeds to tell Watson everything about the owner of the hat, and it's one of the great set pieces of deduction in the Holmes canon, but I had to remove it in order to fit it into our time space here, so I just want to let people know in advance that that's missing, and if you're not familiar with the story, go and read it and enjoy that, too. In particular, because you're not getting it tonight.
I'm sure they can catch up on it. But that's my responsibility and not your, David, because I wanted you to fit in the second story we have planned. Anytime.
So this is The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle. I had called upon my friend Sherlock Holmes upon the second morning after Christmas, with the intention of wishing him the compliments of the season. He was lounging upon the sofa in a purple dressing gown, a pipe rack within his reach upon the right, and a pile of crumpled morning papers, evidently newly studied, near at hand. Beside the couch was a wooden chair, and on the angle of the back hung a very seedy and disreputable hard felt hat, much the worse for wear, and cracked in several places.
"You know Peterson, the commissionaire?"
"Yes."
"It is to him that this trophy belongs."
"It is his hat?"
No, he found it. Its owner is unknown. It arrived upon Christmas morning in company with a good fat goose, which is, I have no doubt, roasting at this moment in the front of Peterson's fire. The facts are these. About 4 o'clock on Christmas morning, Peterson was returning from some small jollification and was making his way homeward down Tottenham Court Road. In front of him he saw, in the gaslight, a tallish man walking with a slight stagger and carrying a white goose slung over his shoulder. As he reached the corner of Googe Street, a row broke out between this stranger and a little knot of roughs. One of the latter knocked off the man's hat, on which he raised his stick to defend himself, and swinging it over his head, smashed the shop window behind him. Peterson had rushed forward to protect the stranger from his assailants, but the man, shocked at having broken the window, and seeing an official-looking person in uniform rushing towards him, dropped his goose, took to his heels, and vanished amid the labyrinth of small streets which lie at the back of Tottenham Court Road. The roughs had also fled at the appearance of Peterson, so that he was left in possession of the field of battle, and also of the spoils of victory in the shape of this battered hat and a most unimpeachable Christmas goose.
"Which surely he restored to their owner?"
"My dear fellow, there lies the problem. It is true that for Mrs. Henry Baker was printed upon a small card which was tied to the bird's left leg, and it is also true that the initials H.B. are legible upon the lining of this hat. But, as there are some thousands of Bakers and some hundreds of Henry Bakers in this city of ours, it is not easy to restore lost property to any one of them."
"What then did Peterson do?"
"He brought round both hat and goose to me on the Christmas morning, knowing that even the smallest problems are of interest to me. The goose we retained until this morning, when there were signs that, in spite of the slight frost, it would be well that it would be eaten without unnecessary delay. Its finders carried it off, therefore, to fulfill the ultimate destiny of a goose, while I continued to retain the hat of the unknown gentleman who lost his Christmas dinner."
"Did he not advertise?"
"No." The door flew open, and Peterson, the commissionaire, rushed into the apartment with flushed cheeks and the face of a man who was dazed with astonishment.
"The goose, Mr. Holmes! The goose, sir!" he gasped. "See here, sir! See what my wife found in its crop!"
He held out his hand and displayed upon the center of the palm a brilliantly scintillating blue stone, rather smaller than a bean in size, but of such purity and radiance that it twinkled like an electric point in the dark hollow of his hand. Sherlock Holmes sat up with a whistle.
"By Jove, Peterson," said he, "this is treasure trove indeed. I suppose you know what you have got?"
"A diamond, sir? A precious stone? It cuts into glass as though it were putty."
"It's more than a precious stone. It is the precious stone." "Not the Countess of Morcar's blue carbuncle?"
"Precisely so. I ought to know its size and shape, seeing that I have read the advertisement about it in the Times every day lately. It is absolutely unique, and its value can only be conjectured. But the reward offered of £1,000 is certainly not within a 20th part of the market price."
"It was lost, if I remember right, at the Hotel Cosmopolitan," I remarked.
"Precisely so, on December 22nd, just 5 days ago. John Horner, a plumber, was accused of having abstracted it from the lady's jewel case. The evidence against him was so strong that the case has been referred to the assizes. I have some account of the matter here, I believe." He rummaged amid his newspapers, glancing over the dates until at last he smoothed one out, doubled it over, and read the following paragraph. "Hotel Cosmopolitan Jewel Robbery. John Horner, 26, plumber, was brought up upon the charge of having upon the 22nd instant abstracted from the jewel case of the Countess of Morcar the valuable gem known as the Blue Carbuncle. James Ryder, upper attendant at the hotel, gave his evidence to the effect that he had shown Horner up to the dressing room of the Countess of Morcar upon the date of the robbery, in order that he might solder the second bar of the grate, which was loose. He had remained with Horner some little time, but had finally been called away. On returning, he found that Horner had disappeared, that the bureau had been forced open, and that the small Morocco casket in which, as it afterwards transpired, the Countess was accustomed to keep her jewel, was lying empty upon the dressing table. Ryder had instantly gave the alarm, and Horner was arrested the same evening, but the stone could not be found either upon his person or in his rooms. Catherine Cusack, maid to the Countess, deposed to having heard Ryder's cry of dismay on discovering the robbery, and to having rushed into the room where she found matters as described by the last witness. Inspector Bradstreet, B Division, gave evidence as to the arrest of Horner, who struggled frantically and protested his innocence in the strongest terms. Evidence of a previous conviction for robbery having been given against the prisoner, the magistrate refused to deal summarily with the offense, but referred it to the assizes. Horner, who had shown signs of intense emotion during the proceedings, fainted away at the conclusion and was carried out of court. So much for the police court," said Holmes, tossing aside the paper. "The question for us now to solve is the sequence of events leading from a rifled jewel case at one end to the crop of a goose in Tottenham Court Road at the other. Here is the stone. The stone came from the goose, and the goose came from Mr. Henry Baker, the gentleman with the bad hat. So now we must set ourselves very seriously to finding this gentleman and ascertaining what part he has played in this little mystery. To do this, we must try the simplest means first, and these lie undoubtedly in an advertisement in all the evening papers."
"What will you say?"
"Give me a pencil and that slip of paper. Now then. Found at the corner of Googe Street, a goose and a black felt hat. Mr. Henry Baker can have the same by applying at 6:30 this evening at 221B Baker Street. That is clear and concise."
"Very, but will he see it?"
"Well, he is sure to keep an eye on the papers, since the loss was a heavy one. He was clearly so scared by his mischance in breaking the window and by the approach of Peterson that he thought of nothing but flight. But since then he must have bitterly regretted the impulse which caused him to drop his bird. Then, again, the introduction of his name will cause him to see it, for everyone who knows him will direct his attention to it. Here you are, Peterson. Run down to the advertising agency and have this put in the evening papers."
"Very well, sir. And this stone?"
"Ah, yes, I shall keep the stone. Thank you. And I say, Peterson, just buy a goose on your way back and leave it here with me, for you must have one to give to this gentleman in place of the one which your family is now devouring." When the commissioner had gone, Holmes took up the stone and held it against the light. "It's a bonny thing. to see how it glints and sparkles. Of course, it is a nucleus and focus of crime. Every good stone is. They are the devil's pet baits. In the larger and older jewels, every facet may stand for a bloody deed. This stone is not yet 20 years old. It was found in the banks of the Amoy River in southern China. In spite of its youth, it has already a sinister history. There have been 2 murders, a vitriol throwing, a suicide, and several robberies brought about for the sake of this 40-grain weight of crystallized charcoal. Who would think that so pretty a toy would be a purveyor to the gallows and the prison? I'll look it up in my strongbox now and drop a line to the counters to say that we have it.
Do you think this man Horner is innocent?
I cannot tell.
Well, then, do you imagine that this other one, Henry Baker, had anything to do with the matter?
It is, I think, much more likely that Henry Baker is an absolutely innocent man who had no idea that the bird which he was carrying was of considerably more value than if it were made of solid gold. That, however, I shall determine by a very simple test, if we have an answer to our advertisement.
And you can do nothing until then?
Nothing.
In that case, I shall continue my professional round, but I shall come back in the evening at the hour you have mentioned, for I should like to see the solution of so tangled a business.
Very glad to see you. I dined at 7. It was a little after 6:30 when I found myself in Baker Street once more. As I approached the house, I saw a tall man in a Scotch bonnet with a coat which was buttoned up to his chin waiting outside in the bright semicircle which was thrown from the fanlight. Just as I arrived, the door was opened, and we were shown up together to Holmes's room.
"Mr. Henry Baker, I believe," said he, rising from his armchair. "Pray take this chair by the fire, Mr. Baker. It is a cold night, and I observe that your circulation is more adapted for summer than for winter. Ah, Watson, you have just come at the right time. Is that your hat, Mr. Baker?"
"Yes, sir, that is undoubtedly my hat."
He was a large man with rounded shoulders, a massive head, and a broad, intelligent face sloping down to a pointed beard of grizzled brown. He spoke in a slow staccato fashion, choosing his words with care, and gave the impression generally of a man of learning and letters who had had ill usage at the hands of fortune.
"We have retained these things for some days," said Holmes, "because we expected to see an advertisement from you giving your address. I am at a loss to know why you now did not advertise."
Our visitor gave a rather shamefaced laugh.
"Shillings have not been so plentiful with me as they once were," he remarked. "I had no doubt that the gang of roughs who assaulted me had carried off both my hat and the bird. I did not care to spend more money in a hopeless attempt at recovering them."
"Very naturally. By the way, about the bird, we were compelled to eat it."
"To eat it?"
Our visitor half rose from his chair in his excitement.
"Yes, it would have been of no use to anyone had we not done so. But I presume that this other goose upon the sideboard, which is about the same weight and perfectly fresh, will answer your purpose equally well?"
"Oh, certainly, certainly,"
answered Mr. Baker with a sigh of relief.
"Of course, we still have the feathers, legs, crop, and so on of your own bird, if you wish."
The man burst into a hearty laugh.
"They might be useful to me as relics of my adventure," said he, "but beyond that I can hardly see what use the disjecta membra of my late acquaintance are going to be to me. No, sir, I think that with your permission I will confine my attentions to the excellent bird which I perceive upon the sideboard."
"There's your hat, then, and there's your bird. By the way, would it bore you to tell me where you got the other one from? I am somewhat of a fowl fancier, and I have seldom seen a better-grown goose."
"Certainly, sir," said Baker, who had risen and tucked his newly gained property under his arm. "There are a few of us who frequent the Alpha Inn, near the museum. We are to be found in the museum itself during the day, you understand. This year our good host, Windigate by name, instituted a goose club, by which, on consideration of some few pence every week, we were each to receive a bird at Christmas. My pence were duly paid, and the rest is familiar to you. I am much indebted to you, sir, for a Scotch bonnet is fitted neither to my years nor my gravity."
With a comical pomposity of manner, he bowed solemnly to both of us and strode off upon his way.
"So much for Mr. Henry Baker," said Holmes, when he had closed the door behind him.
It is quite certain that he knows nothing whatever about the matter. Are you hungry, Watson?
Not particularly.
Then I suggest that we turn our dinner into a supper and follow up this clue while it is still hot.
By all means.
It was a bitter night, so we drew on our ulsters and wrapped cravats about our throats. Outside, the stars were shining coldly in a cloudless sky, and the breath of the passers-by blew out into smoke like so many pistol shots. In a quarter of an hour, we were in Bloomsbury at the Alpha Inn, which is a small public house at the corner of one of the streets which runs down into Holborn. Holmes pushed open the door of the private bar and ordered two glasses of beer from the ruddy-faced, white-aproned landlord.
"Your beer should be excellent if it is as good as your geese," said he.
"My geese?"
The man seemed surprised.
"Yes, I was speaking only half an hour ago to Mr. Henry Baker, who was a member of your goose club."
"Oh, yes, I see. But you see, sir, them's not our geese."
"Indeed. Whose then?"
"Well, I got the 2 dozen from a salesman in Covent Garden."
"Indeed. I know some of them. Which was it?"
"Breckenridge is his name."
"Ah, I don't know him. Well, here's your good health, landlord, and prosperity to your house. Good night." "Now for Mr. Breckenridge," he continued, buttoning up his coat as we came out into the frosty air. "Remember, Watson, that though we have so homely a thing as a goose at one end of this chain, we have at the other a man who will certainly get 7 years penal servitude unless we can establish his innocence. It is possible that our inquiry may but confirm his guilt, but in any case we have a line of investigation which has been missed by the police, and which a singular chance has placed in our hands. Let us follow it out to the bitter end. Faces to the south, then, and quick march."
We passed across Holborn through a zigzag of slums to Covent Garden Market. One of the largest stalls bore the name of Breckenridge upon it, and the proprietor, a horsey-looking man with a sharp face and trim side whiskers, was helping a boy to put up the shutters.
"Good evening. It's a cold night," said Holmes.
The salesman nodded and shot a questioning glance at my companion.
"Sold out of geese, I see," continued Holmes, pointing at the bare slabs of marble.
"Let you have 500 tomorrow morning."
"That's no good."
"Well, there are some on the stall with the gas flare."
"Ah, but I was recommended to you."
"Who by?"
"The landlord of the Alpha."
"Oh, yes, I sent him a couple of dozen."
"Fine birds they were, too. Now, where did you get them from?"
To my surprise, the question provoked a burst of anger from the salesman.
"Now then, mister," said he, with his head cocked and his arms akimbo, "what are you driving at? Let's have it straight now."
"It is straight enough. I should like to know who sold you the geese which you have supplied to the Alpha."
"Well, then, I shan't tell you. So now."
"Oh, it is a matter of no importance, but I don't know why you should be so warm over such a trifle."
"Warm? You'd be warm, maybe, if you was pestered as I am. When I pay good money for a good article, there should be an end of the business. But it's, well, the geese, and who did you sell the geese to? And what will you take for the geese? One would think they were the only geese in the world to hear the fusses made over them."
"Well, I have no connection with any other people who have been making inquiries," said Holmes carelessly. "If you won't tell us, the bet is off, that is all. But I am always ready to back my opinion on a matter of fowls, and have a fiver on it that the bird I ate is country bred."
"Well, then you've lost your fiver, for it's town bred,"
snapped the salesman. "I don't believe it."
"Do you think you know more about fowls than I, who've handled them ever since I was a nipper? I tell you, all those birds that went to the Alpha were town bred."
"You'll never persuade me to believe that."
"Will you bet, then?"
"I'd be merely taking your money, for I know that I'm right. But I'll have a sovereign on you, just to teach you not to be obstinate."
The salesman chuckled grimly.
"Bring me the books, Bill," said he.
The small boy brought round a small thin volume and a great greasy-backed one, laying them out together beneath the hanging lamp.
"Now then, Mr. Cocksure," said the salesman, "I thought I was out of geese, but before I finish, you'll find that there's still one left in my shop. You see this little book? That's the list of the folk from whom I buy. You see? Well then, here on this page are the country folk, and the numbers after their names are where their accounts are in the big ledger. Now then, you see this other page in red ink? Well, that is a list of my town suppliers. Now, look at that third name. Just read it out to me."
"Mrs. Oakshott, 117, Brixton Road, 249, read Holmes.
"Quite so. Now turn that up in the ledger."
Holmes turned to the page indicated. Here you are. Mrs. Oakshott, 117 Brixton Road, egg and poultry supplier.
Now then, what's the last entry?
December 22nd. 24 geese at £7.06.
Quite so, there you are. And underneath?
Sold to Mr. Windigate of the Alpha at 12 shillings.
What have you to say now?
Sherlock Holmes looked deeply chagrined. He drew a sovereign from his pocket and threw it down upon the slab, turning away with the air of a man whose disgust is too deep for words. A few yards off, he stopped under a lamppost and laughed in the hearty, noiseless fashion which was peculiar to him. When you see a man with whiskers of that cut, and the pink un protruding out of his pocket, you can always draw him on a bet. I dare say that if I had put £100 down in front of him, that man would not have given me such complete information as was drawn from him by the idea that he was doing me on a wager. Well, Watson, the only point which remains to be determined is whether we should go on to this Mrs. Oakshott tonight, or whether we should reserve it for tomorrow. It is clear from what that surly fellow said that there are others besides ourselves who are anxious about the matter, and I should— His remarks were suddenly cut short by a loud hubbub which broke out from the stall which we had just left. Turning round, we saw a little rat-faced fellow standing at the center of the circle of yellow light which was thrown by the swinging lamp, while Breckenridge, the salesman, framed in the door of his stall, was shaking his fists fiercely at the cringing figure.
"I've had enough of you, your geese!" he shouted. "I wish you were all the divil together! If you come pestering me any more with your silly talk, I'll set the dog at you. You bring Mrs. Oakshott here, and I'll answer her, but what have you got to do with it? Did I buy the geese off you?"
"No, but one of them was mine all the same," whined the little man.
"Well, then ask Mrs. Oakshott for it."
"She told me to ask you."
"Well, you can go ask the King of Prussia for all I care. I've had enough of it. Get out of this!"
He rushed fiercely forward, and the inquirer flitted away into the darkness.
"Ah, this may save us a visit to Brixton Road," whispered Holmes. "Come with me, and we will see what is to be made of this fellow."
Striding through the scattered knots of people who lounged round the flaring stalls, my companion speedily overtook the little man and touched him upon the shoulder. He sprang round, and I could see in the gaslight that every vestige of color had been driven from his face.
"Who are you, then? What do you want?"
"You'll excuse me," said Holmes, "but I could not help overhearing the questions which you put to the salesman just now. I think that I could be of assistance to you."
"You? Who are you? How could you know anything of the matter?"
"My name is Sherlock Holmes. It is my business to know what other people don't know."
"But you can know nothing of this."
"Excuse me, I know everything of it. You are endeavouring to trace some geese, which were sold by Mrs. Oakshott of Brixton Road, to a salesman named Breckenridge, by him, in turn, to Mr. Windigate of the Alpha, and by him to his club, of which Mr. Henry Baker is a member."
"Oh, sir, you are the very man whom I have longed to meet," cried the little fellow with outstretched hands and quavering fingers. "I can hardly explain to you how interested I am in this matter."
Sherlock Holmes hailed a four-wheeler which was passing.
"In that case, we had better discuss it in a cozy room rather than in this wind-swept marketplace," said he. "But pray tell me, before we go farther, who it is that I have the pleasure of assisting."
The man hesitated for an instant. "My name is John Robinson," he answered with a sidelong glance.
"No, no, the real name," said Holmes sweetly. "It is always awkward doing business with an alias."
A flush sprang to the white cheeks of the stranger.
"Well, then," said he, "my real name is James Ryder."
"Precisely so. Head attendant at the Hotel Cosmopolitan. Pray step into the cab, and I shall soon be able to tell you everything which you should wish to know."
The little man stood glancing from one to the other of us with half-frightened, half-hopeful eyes, as one who is not sure whether he's on the verge of a windfall or of a catastrophe. Then he stepped into the cab, and in half an hour we were back in the sitting room at Baker Street. Nothing had been said during our drive, but the high, thin breathing of our new companion, and the claspings and unclaspings of his hands, spoke of the nervous tension within him.
"Here we are," said Holmes cheerily. "The fire looks very seasonable in this weather. You look cold, Mr. Ryder. Pray take the basket chair. Now then, you want to know what became of those geese?"
"Yes, sir."
"Or rather, I fancy, of that goose. It was one bird, I imagine, in which you were interested, white, with a black bar across the tail."
Ryder quivered with emotion.
"Oh, sir," he cried, "can you tell me where it went to?"
"It came here."
"Here?"
"Yes, and a most remarkable bird it proved. I don't wonder that you should take an interest in it. It laid an egg after it was dead. The bonniest, brightest little blue egg that was ever seen. I have it here in my museum. Our visitor staggered to his feet and clutched the mantelpiece with his right hand. Holmes unlocked his strong box and held up the blue carbuncle, which shone out like a star, with cold, brilliant, many-pointed radiance. Ryder stood glaring with a drawn face, uncertain whether to claim or to disown it. The game's up, Ryder. Hold up, man, or you'll be into the fire. Give him an arm back into his chair, Watson. He's not got blood enough in him to go for a felony with impunity. Give him a dash of brandy. So, now he looks a little more human. What a shrimp it is, to be sure. For a moment he had staggered, nearly fallen, but the brandy brought a tinge of color into his cheeks, and he sat staring with frightened eyes at his accuser. I have almost every link in my hands, and all the proofs which I could possibly need, so there's little which you need to tell me. Still, that little may be as well cleared up to make the case complete. You had heard, Ryder, of this blue stone of the Countess of Morcar's?
It was Catherine Cusack who told me of it.
I see. Her ladyship's waiting maid. Well, the temptation of sudden wealth so easily acquired was too much for you, as it has been for better men before you, but you were not very scrupulous in the means you used. It seems to me, Ryder, that there is the making of a very pretty villain in you. You knew that this man Horner, the plumber, had been concerned in some such matter before, and that suspicion would rest the more readily upon him. What did you do then? You made some small job in my lady's room, you and your confederate Cusack, and you managed that he should be the man sent for. Then, when he had left, you rifled the jewel case, raised the alarm, and had this unfortunate man arrested. You then... Ryder threw himself down suddenly upon the rug and clutched at my companion's knees.
For God's sake, have mercy! Think of my father and my mother! It would break their hearts! I never went wrong before! I never will again, I swear it! I swear it on a Bible! Oh, don't bring it into court, for Christ's sake, don't!
Get back into your chair, said Holmes sternly. It's very well to cringe and crawl now, but you thought little enough of this poor Horner in the dark for a crime for which he knew nothing.
I will fly, Mr. Holmes. I will leave the country, sir. Then the charge against him will break down.
We will talk about that. And now let us hear a true account of the next act. How came the stone into the goose, and how came the goose into the open market? Tell us the truth, for there lies your only hope of safety.
I will tell you just as it happened, sir. When Horner had been arrested, it seemed to me that it would be best for me to get away with the stone at once, for I did not know at what moment the police might not take it into their heads to search me in my room. There was no place about the hotel where it would be safe. I went out as if on some commission, and I made for my sister's house. She had married a man named Oakshott and lived in Brixton Road, where she fattened fowls for the market. All the way there, every man I met seemed to me to be a policeman or a detective. And for all that it was a cold night, the sweat was pouring down my face before I came to the Brixton Road. My sister asked me what was the matter and why I was so pale, but I told her that I'd been upset by the jewel robbery at the hotel. Then I went into the backyard and smoked a pipe and wondered what it would be best to do. I had a friend once called Maudsley, who went to the bad, and had just been serving his time in Pentonville. One day he had met me and fell into talk about the ways of thieves and how they could get rid of what they stole. I knew that he would be true to me, for I knew one or two things about him. So I made up my mind to go right on to Kilburn, where he lived, and take him into my confidence. He would show me how to turn the stone into money. But how to get to him in safety? I thought of the agonies I had gone through in coming from the hotel. I might at any moment be seized and searched, and there would be the stone in my waistcoat pocket. I was leaning against the wall at the time and looking at the geese which were waddling about round my feet, and suddenly an idea came into my head which showed me how I could beat the best detective that ever lived. My sister had told me that some weeks before that I might have the pick of her geese for a Christmas present. I would take my goose now, and in it I would carry my stone to Kilburn. There was a little shed in the yard, and behind this I drove one of the birds, a fine big one, white, with a barred tail. I caught it, and prying its bill open, I thrust the stone down its throat as far as my fingers could reach. The bird gave a gulp, and I felt the stone pass along its gullet and down into its crop. But the creature flapped and struggled, and out came my sister to know what was the matter. As I turned to speak to her, the brute broke loose and fluttered off among the others.
"Whatever were you doing with that bird, Jem?" says she.
"Well," said I, "you said you'd give me one for Christmas, and I was feeling which was the fattest."
"Oh," says she, "we've set yours aside for you. Jem's bird, we call it. It's the big one over there yonder. There's 26 of them, which makes one for you and one for us and 24 for the market."
"Thank you, Maggie," says I, "but if it is all the same to you, I'd rather have that one I was handling just now."
The other is a good 3 pound heavier, said she, and we fattened it expressly for you.
Never mind, I'll have the other, and I'll take it now, said I.
Oh, just as you like, said she, a little huffed. Which is it you want, then?
The white one with the barred tail, right in the middle of the flock.
Oh, very well, kill it and take it with you.
Well, I did what she said, Mr. Holmes, and I carried the bird all the way to Kilburn. I told my pal what I had done, for he was a man that it was easy to tell a thing like that to. He laughed until he choked, and we got a knife and opened the goose.
My heart turned to water, but there was no sign of the stone, and I knew that some terrible mistake had occurred. I left the bird, rushed back to my sister's, and hurried into the backyard. There was not a bird to be seen there.
"Where are they all, Maggie?" I cried.
"Gone to the dealer's, Jim."
"Which dealer's?"
"Breckenridge of Covent Garden."
"But was there another with a barred tail, I asked, the same as the one I chose?"
"Yes, Tim, there were two barred tail ones, and I could never tell them apart."
Well, then, of course, I saw it all, and I ran off as hard as my feet would carry me to this man Breckenridge. But he had sold the lot at once, and not one word would he tell me as to where they had gone. You heard him yourselves tonight. Well, he has always answered me like that. My sister thinks that I'm going mad. Sometimes I think that I am myself. And now I am myself a branded thief, without ever having touched the wealth for which I sold my character. God help me! God help me!"
He burst into convulsive sobbing, with his face buried in his hands. There was a long silence, broken only by his heavy breathing and by the measured tapping of Sherlock Holmes's fingertips upon the edge of the table. Then my friend rose and threw open the door. "Get out," said he.
"What, sir? Oh, heaven bless you!
No more words, get out." And no more words were needed. There was a rush, a clatter upon the stairs, the bang of a door, and the crisp rattle of running footfalls from the street. "After all, Watson," said Holmes, reaching up his hand for his clay pipe, "I am not retained by the police to supply their deficiencies. If Horner were in danger, it would be another thing. But this fellow will not appear against him, and the case must collapse. I suppose that I am commuting a felony, but it is just possible that I am saving a soul. This fellow will not go wrong again. He's too terribly frightened. Send him to jail now, and you make him a jailbird for life. Besides, it is the season for forgiveness. Chance has put in our way a most singular and whimsical problem, and its solution is its own reward."
Oh, David, thank you. That is a very complicated story, huh?
I hope it came across all right.
Oh, no, I think it does it. Much better to hear it than it would be for me to read it.
Good.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the story, but I think we should get to the next one, which is a real treat, mm-hmm. and that's the classic Christmas short story. We were talking earlier that probably the classic Christmas story is Christmas Carol, Dickens. But this is O. Henry's The Gift of the Magi.
This is a lot shorter. The Christmas Carol yes. Qualifies almost as a novella.
Yes, but it has English accents and geese, just like the Sherlock Holmes. I wondered before you started reading it, and it will probably take us almost up to the end of the show, mm-hmm. if there's any thing you want to say about it. Now, this is unexpurgated.
Yeah, straight through. This dates from 1905. And O. Henry was this was the pen name of a fellow named William Sidney Porter, who wrote up roughly 600 stories in his lifetime. He'd been a pharmacist, a draftsman, a bank teller. He may have embezzled funds. He was convicted on a federal indictment and fled to Honduras for 6 months. But he came back to the country because his wife was dying of TB, and So he got sentenced to the Ohio Penitentiary and served three years, 4 months. And then went to New York and began writing hard. And a lot of his stories have been adapted. Ransom of Red Chief, for instance, have been made into movies many times. The Bette Midler, Danny DeVito movie, 1986, Ruthless People, basically lifts the plot of Ransom of Red mm-hmm. Chief. And this one has been filmed many times, too.
Are you ready for us?
Yes.
Okay. I normally talk a lot, but I don't think I should because we'd like to get the whole story in before mm-hmm. midnight. Thanks.
Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. $1.87. That was all. and 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. 3 times Della counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham's Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della. Which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses have been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him. Something fine and rare and sterling. Something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being married to Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you've seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were 2 possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs to which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window some day to dry, just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket. On went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofroni, Hair Goods of All Kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofroni.
"Will you buy my hair?" asked Della.
"I buy hair," said Madame. "Take your hat off and let's have a look at the looks of it."
Down rippled the brown cascade.
$20,
said Madame, lifting the mass with a practiced hand.
"Give it to me quick," said Della.
Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically.
If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87?
At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made, and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair away down the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit for saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered,
"Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty."
The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stepped inside the door, as immovable as a... He stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him.
"Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you."
"You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim, laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor.
"Cut it off and sold it. Don't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?"
Jim looked around the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said, with an air almost of idiocy.
"You needn't look for it. It's sold. I tell you, sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?"
Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit could give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table.
"Don't make any mistake, Dell," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first."
White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the lord of the flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoise shell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession, and now they were hers. But the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with the reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled.
"Del," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on."
The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts such as they are wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi.
You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour on KBOO Portland, the radio show where every day is Christmas. We just heard our guest tonight, David Loftus, reading O. Henry's holiday classic, The Gift of the Magi. And what a great way to enter Christmas Eve. We're just a few minutes away. That's certainly the spirit of the holiday. David, how can listeners find out more about your work and the upcoming Storytime for Grown-Up shows?
Well, as far as Storytime for Grown-Ups is concerned, you can check month by month at the Rose City Book Pub website.
Do you have one coming up in January?
Yeah, Monday, January the 13th. This would be one of the things that Elise likes to do. She likes to turn out all the lights in the big main room at the pub and just have candles on the tables. She calls them blackout nights. Some of her friends like them, and so, you know, some of her regulars like those. So I will be reading the stories and selections from Ambrose Bierce. There'll be a certain amount of creepy crawly. People with tender sensibilities should be warned in advance. But that'll be January's show.
And at any other upcoming events? Well, are you going to be doing it every month now at Rose City Book Pub?
I try to. Sometimes we get schedule conflicts, but I try to do it every month and try to change it up as much as I can, too. Some nights are very fun and rollicking, and others are
dark and frightening.
The other activities I've got coming up is I will be acting in the Oregon Children's Theater production of Journal of Ben Uchida, which opens the last day of February and runs through much of March. It's not your typical singing and dancing children's comedy. It's a very dark and serious story about the Japanese American imprisonment during the Second World War, but it has a lot of personal resonance for me because my mom spent the duration of the Second World War behind barbed wire on her native soil after being born and raised in Hood River.
Oh, wow. That's
so in a sense, I'll be playing my grandfather.
Well, thank you so much for coming into KBOO tonight and starting off Christmas Eve right with holiday cheer and those wonderful stories. I was just enthralled here. It was like being a kid again.
Thanks for asking me, Ken. It was a pleasure.
A lot better than my parents did, though.
I've been at it a while.
Well, that's all for this episode of the Holy Crowley Hour. If there's even the slightest possibility you liked what you heard, you can tune in every fourth Monday of the month from 11 p.m. to midnight, and you can stream and download previous episodes from our Holy Crowley Hour page on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. Many thanks to our special Christmas Eve guest, actor and storyteller extraordinaire David Loftus. You can find out more about David's work and his upcoming events by following him on Facebook under David J. Loftus and also the Rose City Book Pub for those Storytime for Grown-Up shows. And big thanks and a Merry Christmas to Crowley Cult member emeritus Jason Harder and to Ted Jones for engineering tonight's show. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying see you all again next month for our first show of the new year and the new decade, Monday, January 27th, 2020 at 11 p.m. In the meantime, I'll be heading outside the KBOO studios to catch a ride back to Carl Crowley headquarters in Beaverton. Carl will be picking me up in the Crowley Cult Christmas limo, where we'll be chugging a quart or two of his patented eggnog while watching the 1977 Paul Lynde holiday special, Twas the Night Before Christmas, on the limo's 75-inch 4K ultra-high-definition TV with HDR. It's a holiday tradition. Good night, everyone. Coming up next is Joe Woods or someone like him. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a very Happy New Year.
Messing with me.